Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Today is the appearance day of Lord Balaram. Lord Balaram ki jai. I'll not read this verse on the board. Oh, it's no longer there. But a passage from the Krishna book. This is from the chapter about the appearance of Lord Krishna, whose appearance we celebrate in 8 days? Yeah. Janmashtami, the 8th day of the waning moon. So today is the full moon. Sun is in Cancer. Moon is in the auspicious nakshatra of Shravan, the lunar mansion that is connected to hearing. A very auspicious nakshatra or lunar mansion. The Lord also declared to Yogamaya, "My plenary expansion, Anantashesha, is within the womb of Devaki. On account of being forcibly attracted to the womb of Rohini, he will be known as Sankeshan, and will be the source of all spiritual power, or bala, by which one can attain the highest bliss of life, which is called Ramana. Therefore, the plenary portion Ananta will be known after his appearance, either as Sankeshan or as Balarama. In the Upanishads, it is stated, Nayam Atma Balahitena Labdiha. The meaning is that one cannot attain the supreme platform of self-realization without being sufficiently favored by Balaram. Bala does not mean physical strength. No one can attain spiritual perfection by physical strength. One must have the spiritual strength which is infused by Balaram or Sankeshan. Ananta or Shesha is the source of the power which sustains all the planets in their different positions. By Vedic cosmology, Ananta Shesha is a huge serpent and he has many hoods. And on those hoods are resting all the planetary systems. Srila Prabhupada then makes a connection between metaphysics and physics, between the spiritual and the material, if you like. Materially, this sustaining power is known as the law of gravitation, but actually it is a display of the potency of Sankeshan. That's good, thank you. It's a bit distracting out there. Balaram or Sankeshan is the source of spiritual power or the original spiritual master. Therefore, Lord Nityananda Prabhu, who is also the incarnation of Balaram, is the original spiritual master. And the spiritual master is the representative of Balaram, the form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who supplies spiritual strength. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it is confirmed that the spiritual master is the manifestation of the mercy of Krishna. Thus ordered by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Yogamaya circumambulated the Lord and then appeared within the material world according to his order. When Yogamaya, the supreme power of the supremely powerful personality of Godhead, transferred Lord Shesha from the womb of Devaki to the womb of Rohini, both Devaki and Rohini were under Yogamaya's spell, which is called Yoga Nidra. When this was done, people thought that Devaki's seventh pregnancy had been a miscarriage. Thus, although Balaram appeared as the son of Devaki, he was transferred to the womb of Rohini to appear as her son. This is from Krishna book. Omagyana Timarandasa Dinandana Salakaya Chakshulamilitang Jaina Tasmai Shi Guruve Namaha Vanchakalpa Turubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhye Vicha Patitanam Pavanibhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivashadi Gaura Bhaktivrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hari 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 Rama Ram Ram Hari Hari. Balaram, two parts to that word. Bala means strength, and here Srila Prabhupada emphasized it means spiritual strength. Could I have everyone's attention? Ram means the source of all pleasure. Sometimes Ram is used to refer to Lord Ramachandra, the seventh incarnation of the Lord. But more specifically, it tends to refer to Balaram, Krishna's brother. So let's explore a little bit today the relevance of the name of Balaram. And how is this relevant to us? Bala, meaning spiritual strength. Ram, meaning pleasure. The notion of pleasure is an important one in philosophical circles. It's been much discussed, not just in Krishna consciousness, but broadly in philosophy. Yeah, the ancient Greeks had their hedonists, as also does the Vedic tradition with Charvaka Muni. Charvaka Muni was a hedonist. He's well known for his saying that one should, by all means, get ghee. Ghee means clarified butter. In the Vedic tradition, in the present Hindu tradition, it's used a lot for cooking and in lamps. Clarified butter, ghee. So his philosophy was beg, borrow, or steal, but secure ghee, one way or another. Because if you have ghee, you can cook nice foodstuffs and you can eat nicely, and then you will be stout and strong, and you'll be happy. Who likes that aphorism in this room? Put your hands up. Oh, I'll put my hand. Okay. We have a few honest people. Srila Prabhupada mentions that he didn't mention animal fat. He mentioned ghee. There was no question of eating animals. But still, there was an idea of enjoying this world. He's often referred to as a hedonist. Is that the right word, hedonist or hedonist? I'm not sure how you pronounce it. Where you come from, yes. So hedonism, that idea that actually life is meant for the maximum enjoyment. We also had... Actually, the philosophy of today is largely is very much influenced by someone called John Stuart Mill, who was had a philosophy called utilitarianism. And so the idea is that we somehow have to maximize our pleasure and minimize the pain. Therefore, a lot of the debates that go on, moral debates, political debates, social debates, they're based on that philosophy. How do we maximize pleasure and minimize pain? However, philosophers have also been a little concerned about the idea of pleasure. And therefore, the Greeks also had their Stoics, who were well known for their austerities. And even in the English language, the word Stoic is still used to refer to someone who is very austere, perhaps a little dry. He was very Stoic, like we use the word Spartan as well, Spartan or Stoic, very similar meanings. Here, and I read from one authoritative source called Wikipedia. Stoicism is a school of Hellenistic philosophy founded in Athens by Zeno in the early 3rd century BC. The Stoics believed that destructive emotions resulted from errors of judgment, and that a sage or a person of moral and intellectual perfection would not suffer such emotions. Sometimes it's understood that the Stoics are completely against emotions, but apparently the correct understanding is they were against the destructive emotions. So all of us really, doesn't, in the human form of life, we have some understanding, at least in civilized societies, that the senses, indulgence in the senses, has its problems. Even in popular culture, there was one famous British musician, Amy Winehouse, who passed away a month ago and was well known for being a heroin addict. So there's some debates about, very talented, but still we understand if the senses aren't restrained, then we may actually end up dead. We may become addicted. We become degraded. Shakespeare also alluded to this. Karma, lust, the challenge of lust. And in writing on lust, Shakespeare eloquently put it, "All men know it, but none know it well, to shun this heaven that leads to hell." We have an awareness that somehow the sense pleasure has its dangers, its pitfalls, one way or another. The Bhagavad Gita more clearly defines this. Yehi sangsparsha ja bhoga dukkha yonaya evite adyantavanta kunteya na teshu ramate buddha. The word ramate is there again, rama, pleasure. It's again in this verse. An intelligent person does not take part in the sources of misery, dukkha yoni, dukkha yonia. Yoni means womb or source of birth, yoni. And dukkha means misery. An intelligent person does not take part in the sources of misery which are due to contact with the material senses. O son of Kunti, such pleasures have a beginning and an end. And so the wise man does not delight in them. I think all of us have had the experience that we're enjoying, but we're kind of painfully aware this isn't going to go on forever. Therefore, they're temporary. But of course, we have a tendency to become intoxicated with that pleasure at the moment, overwhelmed by that pleasure. There was some honey on the altar today. And speaking to one devotee, he said, actually, today is the one day that it's bona fide, in good faith, that we can get intoxicated on honey. But the material world is also like that. We can become intoxicated by wealth and pleasure. However, we have the Stoics. What do we do in the material world? We want to enjoy, but we understand that there's also dangers in this enjoyment. So there's a tension in the human form of life, isn't there? Don't we all feel that sometimes? It's not easy to give up. In fact, we should beware that when we're teaching or preaching, whatever we do, that we're not putting people off by indicating that we have to give up pleasure. That's a wrong understanding. Otherwise, why should it frighten? Because ananda moya byasat, it's the nature of the living being in its spiritual form, Brahman, to be pleasure-seeking. You can't get rid of that. And therefore, when we hear we've got to give up our pleasure, we feel somehow uncomfortable. So one perspective is, yes, it's material, we should give it up. But another perspective, it's natural to feel uncomfortable when we have to give up pleasure. It's natural. Actually, even Srila Prabhupada had a dream before he took sannyas. He dreamt his spiritual master was calling him, take sannyas. And Srila Prabhupada said, I was horrified. How could I give up the comfort of my home? When one's embodied, that is natural. The Gita gives a clue to this, a well-known verse, Vishaya vinivartante niraharasya dehina rasavajam rasopyasya parangdrishtva nivartate. The embodied soul may be restricted from sense enjoyment, though the taste for sense objects remains. But ceasing such engagements by experiencing a higher taste, he is fixed in consciousness. Fixed in consciousness because the mind is agitated by thoughts of pleasure and pain. So therefore we may try to restrain the mind and senses. Even in everyday circles, someone who wants to give up smoking, they understand it's difficult. The mind is agitated. I must have a cigarette. My father-in-law died as a result of smoking, and he was trying to give it up, and he was sometimes getting a piece of pasta, you know, the thick pasta, as if it were a cigarette. But somehow or other, he couldn't give up. That's the problem. Why? We want that pleasure. So when we feel I'm not getting the pleasure, it is difficult, it's impossible to control the mind unless we get something better. That's the principle of spiritual life. Srila Prabhupada writes, unless one is transcendentally situated, it is not possible to cease from sense enjoyment. The process of restriction from sense enjoyment by rules and regulations is something like restricting a diseased person from certain types of edibles. The patient, however, neither likes those restrictions nor loses his taste. By practicing austerity, we may actually, or sometimes by eating simply, after a while we say, I don't really feel like eating pasta anymore. I've kind of lost that taste. Not quite. We've had that experience. Usually we take a little bit, and then a couple of weeks later we're back into our old diet. Pasta and sweets and so on. We don't actually lose the taste by fasting. It may change a little bit, but ultimately it's the seed of enjoyment to enjoy is still there. We have experience, direct experience. Similarly, sense restriction by some spiritual process like Ashtanga Yoga in the matter of Yama Niyama Asana Pratyayam Pratyahara Dharana Dhyana, etc., is recommended for less intelligent persons who have no better knowledge. But one who has tasted the beauty of the Supreme Lord Krishna in the course of his advancement in Krishna consciousness no longer has a taste for dead things. Yeah, we're trying to enjoy matter. In many topical discussions about men-women relationships, we talk about the male propensity to objectify the female, to see her as an object. So we see we're trying to enjoy dead matter. Therefore, restrictions are there for the less intelligent neophytes or beginners in the spiritual advancement of life. But such restrictions are only good until one actually has a taste for Krishna consciousness. When one is actually Krishna conscious, he automatically loses his or her taste for pale things. So the higher taste principle is well embedded in ISKCON. We have a cookbook called The Higher Taste. Sometimes we think of bliss as being the goal of life. I want to address that a little bit, because even though Anandamaya Vyasat, we are naturally blissful, there are some difficulties if we think that actually pleasure is the goal of life, or even spiritual pleasure is the goal of life. Because without strength, one cannot come to that platform. There's a common phenomenon, I don't know whether you've experienced it. It was interesting because I didn't experience it so much. And that is devotees come, and one devotee came up to me just a couple of weeks ago here and said, for the first year or so, I was really feeling very happy in Krishna consciousness. Now it seems to be drying up. What do I do? Who had that experience in Krishna consciousness? That it was really good at the beginning? Oh, not so many. Usually more. I hear that quite a lot. But certainly whatever happens, whether we do go through those periods of dryness. How do we cope with this when we're feeling dry? Or how do we deal with some material lamentation? Because inevitably, it doesn't mean that becoming a devotee, then everything is hunky-dory and it goes well. My wife often says, watch out what you pray for. If you pray to become a pure devotee, you've got some challenges coming your way. Really. And we mentioned the other day, Karunamayi, there's an English proverb that no mariner, you Dutch can relate to this because you were also mariners. No mariner was trained on a still sea. If you want to be a good mariner, captain of a ship, right? It's no good if you're only sailing on a still sea. The time that you're actually made into an expert captain or whatever, or seafarer, is when it's rough. So inevitably, difficulties will come. What happens also when, not only material lamentation, what happens when our endeavors in spiritual life meet with failure also? This is where bala comes in, strength. One needs that strength that comes from Balaram, the source of strength. This strength is spiritual, not material. I'd just like to say that because Srila Prabhupada emphasizes this. And I'll quote from Srila Prabhupada here from the... this is on the appearance day of Lord Nityananda, so it's a lecture. Prabhupada, yes, that is the secret. Yasya deve para bhaktiya yata deve tatau gurau tasyaite katita hyatak prakashanti mahatmanaha. Famous verse from the Svetashvrita Upanishad, chapter 6, verse 23. If one has unflinching faith in both Krishna and his representative, the Guru, because Lord Balaram is the original Guru, then all the knowledge will be revealed to him automatically. Just like yourself, you are a big scientist. His speech, Prabhupada speaking to Swarup Damodar, who was a scientist. You have talked with me, you have studied with me, and you have examined me in many ways, and I have also spoken whatever knowledge I had. Unless you are convinced, how you can say that you are my spiritual master? So what is the secret? I am not a scientist. How do you agree to accept me as a spiritual master? Because I stick to the principle, Guru and Krishna. That's all. This is the secret of Guru. So today is Baladev. Oh, no, I've got this wrong. This is from another festival. I quoted wrongly there. I made a mistake. Excuse me. So today is Baladev Avirbhava. Baladev is strength. Nayam Atma Bala Hinena Labdaha. You cannot understand or realize yourself without the help of Baladev. You cannot be self-realized without the help of, without the mercy of Baladev. So, our Vivekananda Swami, he interpreted that unless you become stout and strong like the bulls and the buffalo, you cannot realize the self. Srila Prabhupada is criticizing a particular philosophy here. He's mentioned the name. Prabhupada often doesn't mention the name. He usually criticizes the philosophy rather than the person. But anyway, the point is he's actually saying the philosophy is somehow erroneous. He interpreted it like that. So he engaged people to make gymnastics, some exercise. You become very stout and strong, eat meat, and this is going on. This philosophy is going on. Balahitena. Unless you become as strong as a tiger, you cannot realize yourself. This interpretation is going on. Bala hinena labdhyaha. They put forward this argument. Our countrymen are suffering. There is no food. First of all, we must give them food, make them strong and stout. Then we shall talk about Krishna consciousness. Srila Prabhupada is making a point. Because one shouldn't misunderstand this to think that one should neglect spiritual strength. But still, Srila Prabhupada is making very clearly the point that ultimately Bala means spiritual strength, not material strength, because material strength can be finished at any moment. We know that. Something can happen, some catastrophe can happen at any moment. It'll be gone. It is not our own strength. Srila Prabhupada goes on to explain, I'm not going to read this quote, I don't know if we have time, but that even the strength we have in this body comes from the self. Because when the self leaves, there's no strength there. So what do we do when there is difficulty? How is this, you know, how is this bala relevant to us? I'd like to read from another book by C.S. Lewis, who is from Oxford. It's called The Screwtape Letters. You may wonder, actually, why am I reading from a non-Vedic book? But Srila Prabhupada mentions that actually knowledge is knowledge. If you go to a university and then another university offers you a next degree, you don't hesitate to go. It doesn't matter because they're giving you higher knowledge. We may have esteem in our own tradition, and that's natural. But still, one can accept knowledge from anywhere else. And I'd like to read something here because I think it is relevant to the subject matter. So here in Radhadesh, we have our own college, Bhaktivedanta College. The demons also have their colleges. And when the British went to India, they tried to deliberately, through the policy of Lord Macaulay, to actually instill British values in the Indian elite, particularly in Calcutta, the Bhadra Lok, the elite there. And they did a good job. I did. They won over a lot of them, yeah. So that, you know, education is there, and we praise education, but the education can be spiritual, it can be godly, or it can be atheistic. So the demons have their colleges, and they have their projects and their preaching projects in our college also. And here is, in a demon college, there's one student called Wormwood. C.S. Lewis chooses interesting names, Wormwood. And he has a patient that he's trying to convert into Maya. He's trying to bring him to the lower regions. We also have a mentorship program at our college. So Wormwood has a mentor. We have a mentor. And so Wormwood has his mentor called Screwtape. So these letters are called the Screwtape letters. So they're written by a demon teacher to his student. His student was atheistic at the beginning, and he became upset. Wormwood became upset because he became a Christian. So he thought he may lose his soul. Because they're always battling for the soul of the patient. So you have written that you have great hopes that the patient's religious phase is dying away, have you? I always thought the training college had gone to pieces since they put old Slubgob, that's the name of the person, at the head of it. The principal is called Slubgob. And now I am sure. Has anyone ever told you about the process of undulation? Undulation is a difficult word in English. We use the word usually undulating to refer to land that is not flat, as in Holland, nor is it more hilly and mountainous, more hilly as here, but it's kind of going up and down. We often talk about gently undulating rolling landscape. So he talks about undulation, how things go up and down. If you've watched your patient carefully, you would have seen this undulation in every department of his life. His interest in his work, his affection for his friends, his physical appetites, all go up and down. So obviously his spiritual life is going down a little bit at the time, you see. To decide what the best use of it, you must ask what use the enemy, Krishna, wants to make of it, and then you must do the opposite. Now, it may surprise you to learn that in his, Krishna's, efforts to get permanent possession of a soul, he relies on the troughs, the downs. He relies on the troughs more than even on the peaks, like the peak of a mountain, when we're up. Some of his special favorites, Krishna's special favorites, have gone through longer and deeper troughs or downs than anyone else. The reason is this. To us, a human is primarily food. Our aim is the absorption of its will into ours, the increase of our own area of selfhood at its expense. But the obedience which the enemy demands of men is quite a different thing. One must face the fact that all the talk about God's love for men and his service being perfect freedom is not, as one would gladly believe, mere propaganda, but an appalling truth. He's a demon, so he doesn't like that truth. He really does want to fill the universe with a lot of little loathsome little replicas of himself. Creatures whose life on a miniature scale will be qualitatively like his own. Not because he has absorbed them, but because their wills freely conform to his will. We want cattle who can finally become food. He wants servants who can finally become sons. He's using the Christian kind of relationship of father and son. We want to suck in. He wants to give out. We are empty and would be filled. He is full and flows over. Our war aim is a world in which our Father below has drawn all other beings into himself. The enemy wants a world full of beings united to him, but still distinct. It's interesting how Lewis almost alludes to the Mayavadi philosophy of that merging. But he's saying here that, at least in his opinion of the Christian theology, the self ever remains distinct from God. So very consistent with our philosophy. And this is where the troughs come in, the lows in spiritual life. And he goes on, I won't read it all, but he explains he cannot ravish or rape, if you like. This is about, he's speaking about God. He can only woo. You know the word woo? When a man wants to marry a lady, he woos her, he wins her. Mm-hmm. For his ignoble idea is to eat the cake and to have it. The creatures are to be one with him, but yet themselves. Merely to cancel them or assimilate them. Which two philosophies does that relate to? To cancel them or to assimilate them? Shunyavad, Nirvishesh. Yeah? Interesting. Will not serve. Listen to this. He is prepared to do a little overriding at the beginning. He will set them off with communications of his presence, which, though faint, seems great to them with emotional sweetness and an easy conquest over temptation. But he never allows that state of affairs to last long. Sooner or later he withdraws. If not in fact, at least from their conscious experience, all those supports and incentives. He leaves the creature, or the soul, we could say, to stand up on its own legs, to carry out from the will alone duties which have lost all relish. It is during such trough periods, such down periods, much more than during the peak periods, that it is growing into the sort of creature or the sort of self that he wants it to be. Hence the prayers offered in that state of dryness are those which please him best. Our cause is never more in danger than when a human, no longer desiring but still intending, no longer desiring but still intending to do our enemy's will, looks round upon a universe from which every trace of him seems to have vanished, and asks why he is forsaken but still obeys. I thought this was relevant. I mean, I was just struck by how relevant this is to us and how consistent with Vaishnav theology. And we all feel those periods. Therefore, in a sense, if we're relying simply on bliss, it will be very difficult for us to advance in spiritual life. And therefore we have to be prepared, we have to have that strength which comes from Lord Balaram when those periods of dryness inevitably come. There's a similar verse, or a related verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 14, Verse 8, Tatte nukampang shushamikshamano bunjana evatma kritam vipakam hridvag vipurbhir vidadhan namaste jivata yo mukti pade sadhaya bhak. My dear Lord, one who constantly waits for your causeless mercy to be bestowed upon him, and who goes on suffering the reactions of his past misdeeds, offering you respectful obeisances from the core of his heart, is surely eligible for liberation, for it has become his rightful claim. This is a very relevant verse. Why is it relevant? Dayabhag refers to inheritance, the rightful inheritance. So if you've got a father or mother and they're a multimillionaire, and I'm sure many of you can identify with this, really, to inherit that wealth, all you've got to do is stay alive. Right? Make sure you don't die before your parents. Similarly, of course, in this case, the parent is never going to die. One advantage. Therefore, all we have to do is remain alive in spiritual life. Mm-hmm. Very important. It may be that sometimes we're not feeling on top of the world or at our best Krishna consciousness, but are we somehow or other remaining alive in Krishna consciousness? Very important. You must be alive. We should actually be interested in life. I'll come to this later. Life is naturally blissful. Anandamaya Vihasa. Consciousness is nice. Sometimes you read in books, the Hindu people believe that life is suffering. Rubbish! Rubbish! Life is not suffering. Life is blissful. Embodied life is a problem. It's just the body and the mind that's a problem. As soon as you have a body and a mind, we know the problems. We don't have to go through them. But life itself, therefore we should not become negative about life. That is Mayavadi philosophy, actually. Shunyavad Mayavadi. We shouldn't. We should actually be interested in life. I'll come to that later because that's important. As devotees also, we can take a very negative attitude to life, to Kali, Amishashvatam, it's Kali Yuga, Prabhu. Right? It's all true things, but still, what is our mentality about life, embodied life, and so on? We may be pessimistic about embodied life, but we should be optimistic about spiritual life. That is the resolution of that tension, if you like. Two points I'd like to make here before moving on to questions and answers. And we'll finish with a little story of Lord Balaram. One, the duty of the devotee is not to always seek bliss. Rather, the intention should be on the instructions of the spiritual master. It's there that is the bliss, and there is the mercy. Once Srila Prabhupada was on a train, and some ethnic Hindu gentlemen came before Srila Prabhupada. They noticed him moving along the carriage. And in traditional way, Swamiji, please give me your blessings. Srila Prabhupada turned to his disciples and said, these are my blessings. You follow the instructions like they've followed. This is my mercy. Generally speaking, we want mercy to be release from some suffering or some kind of happiness. But actually, the mercy actually is in the instruction of the spiritual master. Srila Prabhupada explains that one should not try and see Krishna in some bush in Vrindavan. because the Krishna is there in the order of the spiritual master. Once, I think it was Tamil Krishna Goswami was saying, Srila Prabhupada, I'm always thinking about money and men, because he was a manager in ISKCON. He said, well, you know, I can't think of Krishna. Srila Prabhupada said, thinking of those things in the service of the Lord is thinking of Krishna. That is thinking of Krishna when it's your service. Very important point. So the order of the spiritual master, it's interesting. In ISKCON we have a phenomenon where when something good happens, we say, Krishna's mercy, it really worked out. And another day we go, oh, goodness, Maya. Maya really got me today. But actually, in a sense, everything is Krishna's mercy. Isn't it? Good or bad. You have to see like that. Another point is that, second point, although spiritual strength is separate from material, we should not think that material weakness or failure is in itself a qualification for spiritual life. In other words, it's not that one is materially unsuccessful and therefore somehow or other he becomes a spiritual success. We should be very, very careful about decrying material success. That is not a sign of spiritual strength. It is mentioned in the Shastras, and I'm not quite sure where, that actually the sannyasi, the sadhu, rejoices in the prosperity of others. Prosperity of others? It mentions the word. Of course, we could interpret what prosperity means. But still, it's not that simply we put down others. That is not a sign of spiritual strength. Spiritual strength means that actually we can actually make even those who are materially successful or apparently externally materially successful, we can give them something better. And you meet people, and recently I met a devotee who was spiritually, materially very successful externally, but he said, but still there is some challenge internally. That happens. I know one devotee, they were very wealthy when they were young, and they had some friends, and she was feeling unhappy, and she said to her friends, why are you unhappy? What would you like? You seem dissatisfied. She said, I'd like to meet, is it Roberto Eco? Yeah. And her friend said, yeah, we can arrange that. The Name of the Rose, he wrote that book. So they said, yeah. She was mixing with such influential people in Italy. But still, even after that, not happy. So it's not. So we should, materially exhausted doesn't necessarily mean we haven't got anything. One may have everything, but still not feeling that satisfaction. Srila Prabhupada criticized those who think the poor are better than the rich. He was criticizing those, again, the impersonalists or the smarters who use the word Daridra Narayan. Poor Narayan. Narayan is a name for Krishna, God. But the sannyasis are sometimes called, because they're representatives of God, they're called Narayan, but Daridra Narayan, because the sannyasi, the sadhu, must be poor, voluntarily give up wealth. So Daridra Narayan. So he was at one point, he said, why don't the rich have Krishna's mercy? What have they done that they don't deserve his mercy? So it's not a question of whether one is materially or spiritually, how one is materially situated. That's not the question. And it's not that actually becoming materially unsuccessful is necessarily a qualification for spiritual life. This was Friedrich Nietzsche's criticism of Christianity, whether it was right or wrong. He said, you know, children, they're playing, and they're not winning at a game. Let's play another game. So let's change the rules of the game. Who is successful and who isn't? So that we become then the successful people. Whereas those dirty, nasty karmis are all unsuccessful. We can do it ourselves sometimes. We also need to to look at that, some of those issues. Srila Prabhupada said, and I've mentioned that, real spiritual strength means we may actually be philosophically astute and try and point out the defects in certain philosophies, but we should be very careful about criticizing. Srila Prabhupada says, someone was criticizing me, that Swamiji, you are introducing this Hare Krishna movement. People are becoming cowards. They simply chant Hare Krishna. So I replied, you will see the power of the Hare Krishna movement in due course of time. There were two battles in India. The battle between Ravana and Ram, Ramachandra. Ravana, the battle of the Ramayana. The other battle was the battle of Kurukshetra. And in these two battles, the heroes were the Vaishnavas and Vishnu. In the Ravana battle, Lord Ramachandra was there and his devotee Hanuman, Vajrangaji. Similarly in the battle of Kurukshetra, Krishna was there and his devotee Arjuna. So Vaishnavas, they do not simply chant Hare Krishna. If there is a need, they can fight under the guidance of Vishnu and become victorious. A Vaishnava's one qualification out of the 26 qualifications, one is daksha, expert. If there is a need of fighting, they can fight like a very expert. That is also needed. Krishna consciousness does not mean one-sided. Krishna is all-pervading. The Krishna consciousness movement should also be all-pervading. It should touch everything, even politics, sociology, everything, if required. Bhagavad Gita, there's a lecture on the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 1, verses 6 to 7. I think maybe chapter 2, I may have written it wrong. 11th of July, 1973, in London. So, interestingly, we also have to engage with the world. That requires strength. Actually, that is real strength. The ability to engage with the world and to have an impact on the world. Srila Prabhupada mentions later, I can't remember the exact quote, but he says that actually when the man is healthy, and the woman is fertile, then there is conception. He actually explains it's usually because the man is not strong enough, husband and wife can't conceive a child. So he says, if you are potent, if you're Krishna conscious, if you have that spiritual realization, that spiritual strength, then there will be conception of Krishna consciousness in the heart of the hearer. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we must have that potency, and it requires great courage and also strength. Spiritual strength is needed to push on this movement. So just to kind of give you an example, to explore an example of how Lord Balaram is the source of spiritual strength. Actually, Srila Prabhupada said, there's only one thing we should pray for. He said, simply, my Lord, please give me spiritual strength. Not, please take away these challenges. Mm-hmm. But give me the spiritual strength to overcome all challenges internally and externally and push on the Krishna consciousness movement. So that's strength. So there's a story of Duryodhana's daughter was named Lakshmana. Duryodhana didn't want her to marry any of his enemies. Anyone from the enemy camp. But Samba, who was the daughter, I think, of Jambavati, Krishna's son, wanted to marry Lakshmana. So, in true Kshatriya style, Samba kidnapped her and took her away. That was the system. And of course, once she's taken, she's had contact with a man, she can't be married to anyone else. That was the Vedic tradition. Once there'd been any contact, not necessarily sexually intimate, but just, he'd actually put her on a, here, on my chariot, you're mine. That's it. She belongs to that man. There are many stories like that, of course. The Mahabharata also, there's stories. So, what happened next? The Kauravas sent an army. They were upset about this. They didn't like this. They sent an army. And they actually had six warriors engage with Sambha. It wasn't really allowed. It really should have been one-on-one combat. But six warriors. Four of them killed his horses. One killed his charioteer. And the sixth warrior cut his bow from behind, his bowstring. And so they managed to capture Sambha. And he was carried away, kidnapped. So this news was sent to the... somehow a messenger went to the Yadu dynasty, King Ugrasena, and told him what had happened. So King Ugrasena was really upset. These Kshatriyas are kind of, they tend to get upset reasonably easily. And he wanted to send an army to free Sambha. But Balaram thought it was wiser to send a diplomat, so he offered to go on a diplomatic mission. And he went and spoke to the Kauravas, and actually said, you know, please give us Sambha back. And at that point, the Kauravas insulted the Yadus. They said that actually we've given you the permission to use the royal insignia, such as the white umbrella. How is it that the shoes are telling the helmet what to do? Because the shoes is the lowest part of the body. So they really insulted the Yadu dynasty. Of course, the Yadu dynasty is special. It's the dynasty in which Krishna appeared. Very powerful. Later, they couldn't be defeated, and therefore they had to commit suicide. You know, they had to fight amongst themselves. That was the only way Krishna could get rid of the Yadu dynasty, by his arrangement. So very powerful. And at that point, Balaram, his eyes traditionally turn red. So Balaram is the same as Krishna, but whereas Krishna is the color of a rain cloud, dark blue, Balaram is like the color of a fluffy cloud, white. And whereas Krishna has a yellow dhoti, Lord Balaram has a blue, royal blue, deep royal blue dhoti. And Antishesha, we mentioned, is also white and blue. So he's got a very white complexion. So you can see when his eyes turn red. So his eyes turned red. And he took up his plow. Because he carries two symbols, a plow and a club. He took up his plow. And he got the city of Hastinapur. And he actually dragged it. He took the whole city and dragged it towards the Ganga, the river Ganga. Or the river Jamuna. I think it was the Jamuna. I think it's called the Ganga because they're the same. And actually all the inhabitants were screaming, and finally the Kauravas relented. Yes, please don't drop our city into the river. So that's the strength. He can actually take, it would make a good film, huh? Dragging a city, a superhero. He could drag a whole city. That's just one demonstration of it. His immense physical strength, but it's ultimately that is a spiritual strength. And still, Srila Prabhupada mentions in the monsoon season, when the rains come up in Delhi, I guess now, Hastinapur was near Delhi, not quite on the spot of Delhi. When the rains come, they say that people still remember that pastime of Lord Balaram and how he actually dragged the whole city towards the Ganga. Jai Shishi Radha Gopinath ki jai, Shishi Gornitai ki jai, Jagannath Paradev Subhadra ki jai, Gaura Premanandi. Questions or comments or any other stories you'd like to share? The one story I like, just before I take your question, is the one of Lord Balaram playing chess. I was recently having a chess game with someone, my wife, and before it I said, may Lord Balaram bless you. Because Lord Balaram isn't very good at chess. So how can the Supreme Personality of Godhead not be good at chess? But actually, a philosopher will object, but a bhakta will always say, this only enhances the character of Lord Balaram, of the Supreme. He's full of inconceivable characteristics. Well, generally speaking, you'll find that where there's spiritual power, there will also be material power, generally speaking. But of course, because that spiritual power comes from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, if he wants to withdraw it at any time, he can do. And as we go through life, towards the end, our material power tends to be diminished. And when we lie on our deathbed, then our material power is going to do us no good whatsoever. There must be that spiritual power. But material power can be there without any spiritual, without any real spiritual prowess. One may be as strong as an elephant, but one may also have the spiritual development of an elephant, which isn't much use. So there's a connection, true. That's true. Generally, where there's spiritual life, other things follow. Dharma, artha, karma, moksha. Those other things follow. And wealth usually follows where there's spirituality. Those things generally come when there's spiritual strength. But without spiritual strength, then everything is very risky. Because you can lose it at any moment. Well, Srila Prabhupada mentions in the Bhagavatam that the opulence that a devotee has is never lost. It always goes with you. Neha bikramanasya sti prityavayun. And the opulence is ultimately spiritual. Wealth, everything we're looking for is ultimately spiritual. So the strength is also ultimately spiritual. Did I answer your question? Go ahead. I mean, that's the process of bhakti, yeah. I mean, you know, where there is happiness, then that happiness can be communicated to others. Through the kirtan or whatever. And therefore one has to have that there must be that potency in the person who's leading kirtan, or the speaker, or whatever, or the pujari. When they've got that potency, that is transferred to other people. So someone comes and sees the deity, and the devotion of the pujari is palpable. You see it. And therefore, actually, Krishna is appreciated in relationship to his devotees. That's how you feel the bhakti. You don't appreciate Krishna separate from his devotees. Yeah. But staying alive means that actually, even if it's, I think in referring to the theme I was trying to establish here, of at least we must stay alive. At times we may be on a peak, and at other times we may be in a trough, we're down, but still we have to stay alive. We keep our spiritual life alive. We should not become, there's another phenomenon, another thing that happens, is that devotees aspire to be in super bliss all the time, or to be super perfect all the time. It's not going to happen. There can be times where, and undulation, matra spashas to kantiya, it's also embedded in our tradition. You know, sometimes it's winter, sometimes it's summer. Sometimes we get up and we're having a good day, and we think we're in bliss. And other days we're bad and we think we're in maya. But sometimes it's the nature of the world, and therefore we have to actually learn to really how do we deal with those changes of the world? And therefore one has to become dhira, matra spashas to kunteya, shitoshna sukha dukha da, agama po yutonita, tungstitiksha bharata. We have to learn to somehow deal or tolerate with those changes. Dhira, Prabhupada mentions one becomes a gentleman. He defines dhira as one who's a gentleman. So we have to actually learn to deal with those changes. And in spiritual life, also peaks and troughs. So that is really, that's part of the process. Not to be surprised when some difficulty comes. That's important. And not to be overwhelmed when some happiness comes. Other questions? We'll finish in no longer than 5 minutes. But any... Yes, Anasuya. To retreat. Yeah. That's an interesting one, because it almost seems therefore to send the army to get her back is the wrong thing to do. I think it was more or less a token, and you find there are quite a lot of stories where once they've had a battle and they've kind of honorably lost it, then they kind of say, okay, that's fine. So it's more or less a question of honor rather than actually winning back the bride. You've got to remember that for a real warrior, fighting is like a sport. It's hard for us to imagine because we're not in that mentality. I've even read articles by those who were knights in the Western culture, you know, the time of chivalry and so on, that, you know, that when they were seated in the saddle, they just lost all fear. They felt powerful. So, I mean, that depends on your nature again. So there was a lot of chivalry there. So it's a question of honor. So that's a little bit I'm guessing a little bit there. But I understand the kind of moral dilemma you're setting, because obviously they don't want to then win back the lady for her not to be able to have to remain a widow, because that's a great misfortune. Yeah. So I think really it was and of course that's what happened. In many cases, I'm not sure in this case what happened. No, I don't think there was a battle, but in other cases, you know, they fight and then it's settled. Anyone else like to add to that? Because obviously that was a great misfortune, and it happened, of course, to, was it Amber? Or Ambika? Amber. It was Amber, yeah. She was actually taken by Bhishma. Yeah. And then she ended up in a position where she was rejected even by the one she'd set her heart. Oh, she'd set her heart on Shalya. So she told Bhishma, "I've set my heart on Shalya." So then Bhishma said, "You can go." No, because she'd actually been kidnapped by... I'm not sure what Bhishma was... Well, Bhishma was thinking, you see, because... my guess is because Bhishma didn't kidnap her for himself, but on behalf of the Vichitravirya, who was the monarch at the time, the emperor at the time. So I guess he was thinking that, not really. So there's a little bit of nuance with regards to morality there, I think. Some details, yeah. Say that again, briefly. Oh, I see, okay. Yeah, there's a question of honor there. Yeah, yeah. 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 This is the male mentality. Power has to be there. But that's natural. Yeah. So that power, any power ultimately comes from Krishna. Unless we're given that power, and there are certain things we're good at, certain things we're not good at. The things that we're good at, we've been given by Krishna. Therefore, we should use them in his service. So yeah, Krishna is very powerful. And so today, if we need power, we need particularly spiritual strength, we should take the opportunity. Please pray to Lord Balaram. Lord Balaram ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.